You are listening to The Tie.
I am Joe McDonald.
Sean Carter.
Brentley Romine.
DJ Pihowski.
Wright Thompson, and you're listening to The Tie Podcast.
The Tie.
The Tie Podcast.
The Tie.
Thank you for listening to The Tie.
Thank you for listening to The Tie.
I'm Dottie Pepper, and thank you for listening to The Tie.
To me, it's like your best contribution to the world is to be the best version of yourself, but golf takes that to like a whole nother level. And Tiger was just like, well, if I'm building a house, do I want to have one tool or multiple tools? And everybody was like, of course you want to have multiple tools. And he's like, well, I have all the tools and they're sharp all the time, so I'm going to build a better house. And everybody was just kind of like, wow, okay.
You are listening to the Tie Podcast. If you're new, if you're not, glad to have you with us. Please assemble your dirt, get comfortable. If you don't know what that means, it's okay. It will get better with time. Today, I am joined by Patrick Grimes, former Stanford golfer, now invested in taking a more all-encompassing view on coaching. We discuss his path to Stanford, his experience, and the decision to turn his back to professional golf. We also discuss psychedelics, the catalyst that dropped a fresh layer of snow over the beaten paths in his life. From that, the mission that came from the experience and how he's going about it. That mission is coaching, but not as a sports psychologist does it, not as a therapist or a dietitian or any singular approach. In his thinking, athletes deserve a more well-rounded approach from somebody who knows them in all their ways. They need somebody to help them be themselves. Of course, we ended it with some golf course architecture talk focused in his home state of CA. We will let you begin with a story and the dirt. Thanks for listening to the Tie Podcast. Before we begin, I want to just share a couple brief anecdotes because I've known Patrick for a long time. Patrick and I are just meeting now, but I've had this running joke with Shimp for like a straight year. I called you Ian because I got pretty sloppy, like reading your Instagram handle, which is I am P Grimes, and called you Ian for a year before Henry was like, who are you talking about? And I said, Ian Grimes. And he was like, that's not a person. So ever since I saw this like ridiculous kind of cut seed ball off a number two at Cal Club, I've been just kind of keeping tabs on Patrick. So excited to be here. Thank you for taking the time.
Of course, man. Yeah. Yeah. Patrick is my middle name, but Ian is not my first name. So
yeah, God. Ian's not in the mix. Before we get started with the actual interview, let's jump straight to the dirt. Patrick, what have you been drinking, eating, reading, and thinking recently?
Drinking, what comes up right away is like this year has been a brand new fresh start, like away from competitive golf. And I've been trying to integrate healthier habits. So cutting back on coffee was a big one for me. So I've swapped that out in the mornings for lemon water. So I've been putting that in there, put like a bit, like a big liter in the morning with the lemon in it. And so I've been drinking a lot of that, just trying to hydrate early, kind of clears up everything out. And it's actually been giving me a ton of energy now. So been really enjoying that. Eating kind of along the same, you know, topic of health, I guess, a lot during the day, like a lot more raw foods. So like been exploring some fresh juices that I'm making at home, some smoothies during the day, like a green or like a banana chocolate smoothie with some dates during the day, and then just, you know, like a bigger cooked meal in the evening. But yeah, a lot more raw foods, so, and a lot more fruits. That's been a big thing for me too. It's been giving me a lot more energy. Reading, I think one of my favorite books lately that I started was it's called The Lion Tracker's Guide to Life. It's by this guy, Boyd Vardy. He's this South African guy who I actually went to a workshop of his at this retreat that I went to this year, and it was incredible. I hadn't heard of him, but he's got like a, he, his, I think it's his family owns like a giant nature reserve in South Africa, and they've run it as a safari. And so he's been like tracking lions with this group of locals for safaris for his whole life. And he has this like really cool blend of like, where he wrote a book, this book to like combine the metaphor of tracking lions with life skills. And so it's been, that was like a, it's really short. It's really, really well written, really poetic. So I really recommend that. It's called, yeah, The Lion Tracker's Guide to Life. What's the last one? Sorry. Thinking.
Yes. And it can really be anything.
Yeah. Thinking, been trying to think less. I think that's a big one for me. I sort of relearning life in general these days since getting out of competitive golf completely this year and transitioning. So yeah, just like trying to quiet my mind more and like trust that I'm going in the right direction, and just, you know, see what comes up, but kind of knowing I'm not going to jump back into what I was doing before. Or I'm not going to, you know, try to freak out too much doing a whole different thing with life these days. So yeah, that's kind of where I'm at right now.
That is some of the better dirt that I've heard in a long time. So thanks. I read that you grew up near Stanford. Is that right? Where did you grow up, and tell me about home?
I grew up in Palo Alto mainly. I actually first learned to play golf when I was, we lived in Portland. So that was kind of when I got started in the game. And then we moved to the Bay Area when I was 5. So I grew up there in Palo Alto near Stanford. Been here. Yeah, been in this area pretty much my whole life. Been fortunate enough to travel a lot and see the world with different opportunities with golf and things like that. But yeah, grew up here and planning to stay here for the long term.
I love it. Tell me about, you know, growing up, what you thought of Stanford and your experience playing there. What is it like? What was it like being in the program when you were there? I mean, I'm very familiar with Henry's experience being so close to him, but I'm just one. I know that things change drastically, and a lot of things stay the same too. What was your experience like being a student there?
Yeah, it was amazing. I loved it. I feel like early on, you know, from having spent a lot of time around the Stanford campus, it got pretty embedded in my vision for the future. Like, you know, our neighborhood was walking distance from the football field. So it was a big thing in our neighborhood, like block parties on the weekends around Stanford football games and going to those. And so, you know, pretty early on when I started competing and playing a lot, it was like definitely at the top for me of trying to get there, especially because, you know, I was around golf in like prime Tiger era, you know, like I was probably 8 or 9 when he went on that 2000 to 2000. Well, I was 8 years old when he was going on that run in 2000, 2001. And so, you know, I really super inspired by him, just like anyone, but really in my like crucial junior years of, you know, really getting into the game. So, you know, that made me even more want to be associated with Stanford and part of the program. So I got to know Conrad pretty well from doing some of the junior camps they had during the winters and in high school, and wanted to just, you know, hopefully figure out what I needed to do to impress him enough to get a spot. And luckily, you know, I played well during some of the important like recruiting years in high school, had a good career locally and won a couple national events. And I think I was like, I don't know, maybe top 50 or 100 in my class nationally. coming in. We had a really good recruiting class. I was the lowest ranked player coming in. We had Patrick Rogers and this kid, Marcel, from the Philippines, who was a great player. But yeah, I mean, my experience was awesome. I mean, it's like, especially after having played some of the lower level pro stuff and some of the bigger events here and there sprinkled in, but like the courses that these top D1 programs play, it's just like, it's really unbelievable. And the events that they put together, and, you know, we would start every year at Olympia Fields in the fall, and then we would start every winter season or spring season, like in January in Hawaii. So we'd go out to Waikoloa and play some other courses around there. And, you know, just had like a great rotation, going around. We won two conference championships. So we had a really good team. With where I stacked up, I felt like kind of in a fighting mode to start a lot of the time in terms of the top five. I had some good streaks, and toward the end of, it was really fun. The end of my freshman year, I got on a nice run of contributing and playing a lot towards the end. And then we played the national championship at Riviera in 2012. So that was a real highlight experience for me in college. And then, you know, it's just so much fun, like not that many different chances to play on a team in golf. And so that's something that I'll always, you know, look back on with great memories. Just so many of my closest friends from traveling around that I'm still in really close touch with. And it's just really easy to lose that and not have that camaraderie, like at the pro level, and just kind of be isolated. So I think that part, you know, combined with just being with some close friends and, you know, having a great team, it was a lot of fun.
Skipping forward quite a lot to graduate school and then where you are today. Tell me about that process. I kind of want to fill in the gaps here later on, but what have you been up to the last maybe couple years? And I know you said in your dirt, that trying not to look ahead too much, just kind of trying to localize and stay a bit more present, which I respect, but where have you been and where do you feel like you're headed, generally speaking?
Yes. To answer your question, like I played professionally after college until last year. There was a break in there where I caddied on tour in 2018, but last year was kind of like, you know, I was pretty much in that world until last fall, when I just really decided like, okay, this is time to make a bigger change and get away from this and do some different things. And so that was when I applied to graduate school for counseling psychology at Santa Clara. And so I started that program at the beginning of this calendar year. So I started that program. It's a 3-year master's program. Technically it's marriage and family counseling, but that's sort of a general way that, you know, people get their master's for counseling is that particular track. And then also teaching, coaching part-time out here in the Bay a few days a week and getting some experience working with people. And that's kind of the general umbrella that I'm working in now is coaching and, you know, figuring out my way of integrating all these past experiences and lessons learned and trying to find the best way to help other people out and see like which direction that's calling me.
So, you know, I thought a lot about this because especially kind of preparing for this episode and thinking about what you've been up to the last year or so. You know, if you play golf at a really high level, like this is kind of why we name the Tie Podcast the Tie Podcast. It's like, yeah, we all love golf, but, you know, at the end of the day, we all kind of have our story for kind of where the game of golf pushes and pulls us in life, you know? So, you know, you play really hard for a long time, compete, have some success, have some failure, learn some things, And then the game of golf just kind of like spits you out on shore. And now you got to go like be a human, you know? So at least what you're learning right now, what's the big takeaway from, you know, your life of competitive golf that you're now kind of walking away from or walking alongside or however you want to put it? What was the big takeaway from the game? What was your tie?
I think my biggest takeaway at first on a personal level is just like how lucky I feel that I found something that gave me so much meaning in my life really early on, because I think that people go a really long time looking for that and not knowing exactly what that means to them or where to find it or how to go about it. And so, you know, there's so many different opportunities and things to explore and directions to go. I think for me, it was like learning what that feels like so that I have kind of like a standard for myself of like finding what that looks like in the future. So like that level of excitement and that level of purpose, you know, that reason to that fire, reason to get up in the morning. Like I kind of golf really gave me like just a very clear sense of that. And I think especially now going forward into something completely different, I feel like I can sort through things a little bit more clearly because I'm like, okay, well, I'm noticing like how it feels to be teaching all the time or going to class or doing this or that. And it's been able to help me compartmentalize things a little bit and be like, okay, it's definitely not this thing, or this is interesting a little bit. Maybe what happens if I go a little bit this way? And you know, just I guess at the end of the day, like for such a long time, golf was a really clear purpose and a really clear goal oriented thing. And so I think operating from that perspective of like, okay, it feels really good to be doing something that feels purposeful. And now like expanding that outward to, you know, I think where I struggled for a while was just how self-involved it got, you know, like that's great to work on yourself and be, you know, your best, to me, it's like your best contribution to the world is to be the best version of yourself. But golf has like a weird, takes that to like a whole nother level where like you can't, you don't have, at least I didn't do a great job of like really balancing my life in other ways. And so it's like, you kind of have to put yourself first, but you do it over and over and it can kind of become like a loop where you're just maybe going too much into the self-searching mode or the self-fixing mode, like trying to change stuff or fix stuff. You know, every player is different, but it usually doesn't go very well if you're constantly in search mode. And that's like sort of the place that I got to. And it really like made me super hungry for like learning stuff and knowledge, but it also made me like change my swing too much and not trust the direction I was going in. So for now, it's really exciting because that's given me like a ton of different, knowledge on how to look at the game and how to coach people. And it's been a lot more fun to not just be like totally wrapped up in my own stuff and try to take some of the same things, but come from the place of like, okay, now I can like help other people with all these things.
Yeah. So the obvious place to go first is to say, okay, well, how are you going to help people through the game of golf? You're already doing that. But we spoke earlier, you were talking about how that really, the interest at least, and kind of the path is much wider than that. Talk to me about that process, how you kind of got there, and what some of those interests are and where you apply it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think for me personally, it started with psychedelics. I was a sophomore in college and kind of at a point where with my game, I was starting to think pretty high level about which direction I wanted to go, whether it was like to lean all the way in and keep working on my game and, you know, kind of have in the back of my mind, like, oh, I want to turn pro, or, you know, is this, you know, cause that's right around the time when you have to like declare your major and stuff. And with golf, it's can be hard to balance certain things. And at the time, yeah. I had no idea what I, you know, academically, what direction I really wanted to go. But, you know, I was kind of thinking to myself, like, all right, if I'm going to go a little bit harder on that direction, then I might need to make some changes with my commitment to golf. And so I was, you know, had been so all in on golf all the way up to that point, and I wasn't really getting the results in college, that it was pretty disorienting and depressing for me. So there was a lot of like new stuff mentally coming up from that. And just by chance, someone on the baseball team that I was playing golf with over like a winter break told me about ayahuasca, and I just had never heard of it and didn't know what it was kind of curious. But I had a relative of mine who I thought was like the only person would know something about it maybe. So I contacted her, and she knew somebody who was facilitating in the States. And I got in touch with this guy and ended up flying out to do a ceremony. I was like 19. So, you know, it was just, that was like my first exposure into this kind of, I don't know, holistic healing world of things, I guess, you know, just totally brand new. And so, you know, that was what kind of got me sort of more interested in like the human psychology side of things. You know, I've been so locked in on golf, but that was a time when I remember realizing that like personal things were holding me back and like showing up on the golf course. And so that's like where I really started to realize like, wow, okay, like there might be things in my game that are coming up, like shots that I'm hitting or situations I find myself in or, you know, emotional cycles, but like, that's not the real reason like that this is really happening. Like it's these other things, and then it's kind of manifesting on the golf course. And so that was when I started to get my wheels turning about like, okay, this is all really connected. And I don't think there wasn't really a lot out there in terms of people approaching golf that way that I had been exposed to. So just got me more progressively interested. This was really only like my tool to just keep exploring myself. So I guess the easiest umbrella to put it under is like spirituality, I guess. I mean, I just kept like exploring these other techniques, other psychedelics, other ceremonies, reading stuff, breath work, meditation, journaling, just like kept going. And when I was younger and through my 20s, it was really kind of like almost like trying to give myself superpowers. Like if I figure out how this all works, then like I'm going to be unstoppable. And, you know, I'll be like that'll be like my thing, and I'll be that guy and whatever, I'll get all this attention for it or whatever. Like that was sort of, I just kind of thought of my edge in a way, like that's how I thought of it initially. And then it's like, the further you keep going with it, you kind of realize how that part, that paradigm was holding me back. And it just, so it got me further away from, over time, from like just my own self, and it got more into like figuring out a way to try to make a bigger impact with other people. And so that's kind of what's, you know, that was like sort of the crossroads I hit last year, was I just felt like I was spinning my wheels working on this journey just for myself. And just, I was turning 30 last year, so I was just not really in a place with my game where I felt like it was really time to lean in if I was going to make a career out of it. And I just didn't think I wasn't in a place with my game, and from what I had seen in my results up to that point, where I couldn't like lean all the way in and feel like I was going to approach that without, you know, doubts that would kind of stop me. So I just felt like that's a good time to keep going in this other direction that I've uncovered along the way. And so that's what led me towards this grad program and now coaching and helping people with their games and just putting my ideas out there online in a way that kind of makes me uncomfortable, but sort of finding that it's resonating a lot with people. And so I'm just trying to push myself to kind of get it all out there, kind of under the umbrella of trying to make a better impact.
Yeah. What an answer. I'm curious. I do, and I apologize in advance. I do want to jump into psychedelics briefly because I feel like it's important. Probably most of our listenership, I wouldn't imagine, are big psychedelic people. Mm-hmm. I'm really open-minded on the idea. In fact, I think it's great. And I know these things can be, A, they can be personal. B, I know everybody's experience is different. But I've heard from many sources that they can be incredibly profound. Would you say that it was a catalyst to some of these ideas? Was it a snowball? How would you describe, not the experience, but kind of, okay, just had the experience. This is what I'm taking with me. You know, this is my change in direction. Explain that portion of it.
Yeah, 100%. I think the way I sort of, the most satisfying analogy I can think of that I've tried to use to describe this is sort of like tracks in a snowy mountain or something, where it's like you get into these grooves where if you see people skiing down a mountain, there's all these grooves, right? And there's like a very specific way that our brain does the same kind of thing. Like we fall into these very specific patterns. These grooves are kind of cut out. They're like the way that everything kind of flows in that direction. We're used to it. We're familiar with it. And that's just like who we think we are. And we just are used, we go that direction. We don't really think twice about it. And it's just the way that we connect with ourselves is, you know, through a pretty small, the things we do every day, the things that we eat, the stuff we watch on TV, the people we talk to, right? It's all pretty consistent for the most part. Our days are pretty ritualized, right? And so the experiences with plant medicines sort of have this way of like wiping the tracks away a little bit. Like you get off the beaten path to a fresher part of the mountain, and it's open-ended, and you can kind of explore wherever you want to go, and it will very often find you, you know, having a very different opinion of yourself and life and just perspective on how you think about things. So like the other analogy I think of is like being in a maze where the walls are super high and it's like, you know, you can't see above it, and you're just kind of going piece by piece on, not on autopilot, but just you're going along day to day, not looking too high up. You don't know exactly where it's going, but it's going to end up somewhere that is the end of the maze, right? And you don't know which way to go all the time. And these experiences almost have this way of like lifting you up above so you can look down at the whole picture and see like, oh, that's how I got to where I am now. That's where I'm going. That's an option. I could do this, I could do that. They have this way of like, you know, one of my most profound experiences and challenging ones with ayahuasca was like when I remember having, it was multiple days in a row working with the medicine each night. And the previous night had like the most ecstatic, best thing that could have ever happened. And all I remember thinking to myself was like, I just want that again. Like, I just want to go right back into that, re-experience it. And just like stay in that space. And I remember like after maybe an hour or two in on this following night, it wasn't really happening. And there was like, I was looking around, I was freaking out around all these people. It started like, you know, it started really like getting me anxious and worked up. And then I remember just thinking to myself like, well, I feel like shit. And this is just how tonight's going to be. And I'm just going to have to sit here and deal with it. And I remember like deciding to myself, like, oh, this is how it's going to be. And just make, and like feeling like a victim to that. And I just like a light bulb went off. I was like, oh my God, that's how I deal with everything. So it was like this very isolated moment of like just enough of being in a different state where you realize, and I didn't even really feel the effects in any particular way. It felt like I was just sitting there, but it just has this way of like allowing you to like access a part of yourself. Maybe it's just the space that you set aside, whatever, you know, to be in this room for a few hours or a whole night and just kind of be thinking. But it just has this way of like leading you into your mind in a way that just feels different. And so when you do that, you go somewhere new, and then just eventually it's like sometimes the light bulbs go off, and that's where I think people get those like really profound insights. But it doesn't, to me, it doesn't, hasn't felt that much different than something like, I always go out of those things feeling like that's totally accessible in other ways. You know what I mean? Like
if we, yeah, all, so that kind of leads me into like, you could make the argument that breath work is an avenue to that. You know, it's totally. Like a, it's like an off stream, may not be the potency of that, but it is it's a natural way of like achieving part of it maybe. Totally. So, just, I know there are probably six or seven things that we could jump into, but tell me about breath work. This is something I've talked about on the podcast before. Mm. How did you meet breath work? How has it evolved? How does it help you?
Yeah. I think when you talk about ways to bring this kind of perspective into the day to day, that's like the first place my mind goes. Like this is like real technology to go into like a psychedelic state, and not even, doesn't even have to be that intense. Just, I think most of it has to do with the duration that you do it, when it things like really start to change. Like as a daily few minute thing, it might just wake you up, make you feel good, energized. But it started for me in maybe like, I don't know, maybe 4 or 5 years ago. I went to a Wim Hof workshop here in the Bay Area, where he just, he talked for a while, had a couple speakers, played a bunch of music. And then at the end, they just did a bunch of ice baths, in like a group type setting. So that was like my first, we did all the breathing in this big group and then got everyone super hyped up. And then we all went outside and did the cold plunge. And for a while after that, I was kind of doing the daily practice, doing a few rounds of like the Wim Hof, where you're, doing like 30, 40 breaths in a row and then holding for as long as you can, going through that kind of cycle, and then maybe doing like a cold shower after or something like that. And I had some pretty long streaks doing that kind of stuff, but you know, it's always been something that's like available. I've explored other ones that are similar, all kind of in the same realm of like maybe longer 20 to 30 minutes of like more rapid breathing. You know, so I've explored stuff like that. And then this year, I'm doing a particular program that's a year long and has some retreats, and there's a couple hundred people, but they bring in for the retreats, they're doing like workshops of a bunch across like a bunch of different types of these techniques. So one of them was this couple from LA that have a company called Awaken Breathwork. Awaken, but with an O at the beginning. And they took this whole group through like this long hour plus long guided breathwork ceremony thing in this like huge space with a couple hundred people and music and stuff. And that was like probably the most intense like psychedelic type of experience I've had, maybe of all these things. So that was when I started realizing like the group dynamic, like the letting go part, it like at the end of the day, whether it's isolation or I don't know, there's darkness retreats now, there's fasting, there's psychedelics, there's breath work, like whatever the thing is, it's the theme is along like either depriving yourself or like overstimulating yourself or like, you know, getting out of your comfort zone in a particular way. And the theme of it is like, when you extend the window that you're doing something like that, things have a way of surfacing. And so, you know, it can be hard to get to that state just in a one-on-one like talk therapy type of environment. But when you do these other more radical approaches, it has a way of like, you know, you're doing it just by yourself. So nobody's like forcing you into a place that you're not comfortable with mentally, emotionally, whatever. And you know, you have, you know, a technique to follow and you've made an agreement for a specific amount of time. That's a really, really big part of it, I think, why these are so effective in groups is like, it's so easy to just like get 5 minutes into something when you're at home, be like, oh, it doesn't feel good. Like I need to stop. And that's totally normal. But where, when you start to explore this a little bit more, you realize like, wow, okay, that's part of it. Like that's part of the ceremony or that's part of the class that I'm in. Or this, you know, I've made this agreement to be in the space. And so that's where I realized how insanely powerful it was to do this in like a group setting. And then you can come back and do it at home, but at least you know, like, oh, I've done this for longer and I know what it's like and it's safe and it's okay. And like, it's just all these things that are like, it's not bad if I feel a certain way or it's not like I'm doing it wrong. Like that's where the work is and that's part of it. And for me, that's where kind of the theme of all this stuff is like doing the work. It's like letting things come up that we have a very easy, you know, without a lot of resistance in life, we can bury it down pretty easily. So using these types of techniques is really helpful in getting things to like come up and be cleared out. And, you know, as a result, being like lighter and happier and better off as a result of it. So whether it's breath work or these other types of things, like they're all kind of in that same realm of like either depriving or overstimulating and like just clearing things out of your system.
Makes a lot of sense. Makes a lot of sense. Translating this to golf and coaching. This catalyst has sent you on this path. And I remember you saying you're, again, really trying to just kind of be where your feet are, which I think is awesome. But to round out kind of your perspective, your philosophy, your ethos, what you're going to take to players that you want to work with, not just players, but whoever you want to work with. If there are any holes there, can you try to fill them in just so we can get a full idea of kind of what you want to bring to the player, like maybe even the pain points, you know, like if you're describing a great product, like what pain points are it solving? What pain points are you looking to tackle that players with, you know, sports psychologists, you know, anything down to the performance, what are you focused on changing?
Yeah, I think I'm focused on changing their relationship and understanding of themselves. Cause I think that's where your, you know, superpowers or whatever, you know, really become relevant as an athlete. That's sort of like the quest I was on that really led me somewhere else. But, you know, it's like to have access to knowing yourself so well that nothing's really going to get to you. And that's where I think putting yourself in these uncomfortable situations, and you know, golf is such a mental, emotional game that to have that, you know, like I think when you talk about like filling in the gaps, to me it's like really having tools. I think there's a lot of talk in sports psychology and there's a ton of tools, but a lot of them have to do with just like, you know, things that you tell yourself that don't like carry a lot of weight behind them maybe. And I think that's where I ran into some frustrations where it was like, okay, of course the right things are being said by another person. Like, of course it's obvious that like I need to trust myself or think less or do this or that. But like what, you know, at the end of the day, it's like, well, what's the reason that I don't trust myself? Like, where does that come from? Like, at what age did that start? Or like, at what experience did I have that, you know, where I internalize that belief about myself and I'm like running this program still. It's like, if you have the knowledge of yourself in a way that like makes you kind of bulletproof on who you are and sort of, and why and what's led you there, then that's what really gives you the power to like make different choices and change it. Cause like, if you're able to, if you have awareness of where you're at in any given situation, then that's really how you can separate yourself from it. And if you can do that, then you really can make different choices about like a different decision to make or a different thing to tell yourself. So it's like just having tools to really access that and really know it, instead of just like trying to do the right thing all the time. It's like building that awareness. And when it comes to working with athletes, I could see myself having a process of like, you know, it's not just the time on the range or the course. It's like, you know, in-person types of deeper conversations, knowing them better. Like, to me, I like that I'm developing like a counseling background, because like I said, you know, through my experience, it's also connected that if you're coaching people, you want to have as wide of a, you know, area of knowledge about a person as you can, so that you, if it's like, if it's not a swing thing that's working, okay, there's maybe some emotional thing, or there's some sort of past experience or this or that, like just to have more ways to work with them. So I guess what I hope to offer working with athletes is just more tools, like, hey, let's do a breathwork session, or if on the road, the legal landscape permits like guided ceremonies, or if I'm, you know, trained to kind of offer that kind of work, just to have more ways for athletes and for people to just like, you know, get rid of the stigma about some of these things and like offer opportunities for people to realize like, wow, these things go really, really deep and really, really help. And I think I'm excited about this, particularly with athletes, because they're already coming from the place of like, okay, if this is like proven and this works for people, like I'm all in. And that's how I was. And I know that's how so many great athletes are, is that like they have a lot of willingness to really go for it. And that's sort of, you know, that's such helpful fuel to the fire when you're doing this kind of work or starting to explore it. So, you know, but being able to offer a lot of different kinds of things and being like really trained and experienced to feel like I have some solid ground to stand on. That's sort of, you know, how I see myself like taking it out to working with other people.
So I kind of, as much as I want to continue trying to kind of wrap things up in the next few minutes, I'm curious, you know, this could be a long question, but the technology in golf, like if you take this direct to golf, the technology has changed so much. So much has changed in golf, like really since you were a junior. For your coaching now, I kind of want to like get this question in. I should have asked it earlier. Trackman, I'm also curious what your interest is in it, but Trackman, 3D motion analysis, so much different understanding about the golf swing. What's your take, just as a, now that you've gotten to look back on the game a little bit, what's your take on not only equipment, but kind of the way golf is heading as far as technology goes?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting time to be, like, I was exploring this so much with my own swing. And I think my generation is in a really interesting place with this stuff, because the knowledge is there, but the reps and experience, probably like the foundation that we learned on, was definitely a lot more rocky than it was for a lot of other players. Like the level of instruction I was brought up with was just not very good. I think like there was a lot of limitations and a lot of bad information, a lot of bad coaching out there. And, you know, I was always searching for ways to improve my own game and kind of shopping around, but it led me to kind of make endless changes. And so I think there's like a threshold where, almost like plastic surgery or something, where like you can be doing the right things, but you do it too many times and you lose sight of like your core DNA, and it doesn't matter if it looks like this, or it's shallowed out, or it's square, or doing this or that. Like, if it's not you, you know, day in and day out, you're going to make adjustments that just make it harder to repeat. And so I think right now it's interesting working with, you know, with players who have more of a old school background, figuring out, like, for me, I'm really trying to make sure I'm not being one dimensional in how I approach the golf swing, like really trying to get better at figuring out what are like the core elements that make people tick, and, you know, what to make sure you keep and what can be changed to make them better. That is just like such a subtle art in coaching that is so important, but I think it's way more important with like people who really have established their game already versus like now younger kids being brought up with all this stuff. You know, they're so young and malleable that like they can get more mobility or range of motion, or if they're learning certain movements at a young age, they're going to be super bulletproof, right? And they're not going to need to change it. So I think having a more clear framework is like totally fine with younger kids when they're first learning, but then it becomes a lot more subtle when it's like, okay, maybe that's not going to work for somebody who's been doing it a certain way their whole career. And so I know that for me, I worked a lot on trying to perfect certain movements that just don't match how my body moves and what's kind of my DNA. So it's been fun for me to make some adjustments based on that, but I'm learning a lot from teaching people. But I also think, you know, with the younger generations, like I really hope that the talent doesn't get coached out of them, because I think that there's like a very clear picture of like perfect technique. And, you know, in the next 10, 20 years, you're going to see pretty much all these swings looking the same. I think it's going to look more and more identical across the board, tons of power, tons of rotation, tons of speed, good at everything. Like the bar is just going to keep getting higher because kids can perfect stuff really, really fast with all this technology when they know exactly what to do, especially if they have good coaching. So there's a lot less guesswork involved, but I certainly hope that doesn't mean that kids aren't out there, you know, trying to shape shots and see how many tools they have in their arsenal. I think that there's like this long debate about curving the ball versus having one shot all the time. You know, I hear that debate all the time. And I remember Conrad, our college coach, asking Tiger that in front of all of us. And when he came to visit one time, and Tiger was just like, well, if I'm building a house, do I want to have one tool or multiple tools? And everybody was like, of course you want to have multiple tools. And he's like, well, I have all the tools and they're sharp all the time, so I'm going to build a better house. And everybody was just kind of like, wow, okay. You know, maybe you have a favorite tool that you go to and you hit that, you have that more consistently. But his framework was like, oh, I just go to the range in the morning and figure out which ones are the sharpest, and I go with those that day. And I'm always trying to craft a bunch of different. And I think you should really be coming from that place of like, of course you should be able to do everything. And then you have, just like we were talking about, you know, with, you know, your own personal work, it's like, you know what you can do, and then you make a choice, kind of the same thing in your game, right? Like you can hit all the shots, but then you pick which one is most comfortable, right? So I really hope that doesn't get like taught out of younger players, because, you know, it's just so much more fun to watch the talent with some of the more creative guys. So I think I hope the art form keeps getting preserved in the game, and it seems like it's just going to be more and more fun to watch players because the standard is just getting so like crazy high at fast. So it's going to be fun to see where it goes.
I think that's a great perspective. There seems to be a lot of debate on, you know, are golfers better athletes, you know? But I think that perspective that, you know, kids have different information at, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years old, you know, as early as kids are playing golf, to develop habits, just like learning a language. And then once their body is used to those movements, you train up from there. And then the best athletes win, and the best are going to be really, really good. So, I see and hear a lot of arguments on the golf ball. I don't know if I agree that golfers are better athletes than they were, you know, 50, 60 years ago, but they're better equipped than they were. And they're not wrong for kind of adapting to the new technology. Yes. Patrick, one more question before we kind of wrap this thing up. You've played a lot of really good golf on really good golf courses, good conditions, you know, under pressure. What is your perspective, if any, on golf course architecture? What to you is good golf?
Like good golf course design or something like that?
What kind of golf do you enjoy playing? You know, what's the locale? What, if any, course architects work do you really like? What are the most exciting courses to play in competition? What to you is good golf?
Yeah. I, as a West Coast California guy, I struggle sometimes with the like swampier designs that have like tons of water everywhere. I think no matter what, if the course has a good design with the lay of the land, I think that, you know, you can always pick up on that where it's like, oh, this blends really well with like the natural terrain. And that to me is like what makes a good design is like, does it look like it was just, you know, it someone woke up one day and it just looked like that. I think the good courses really have that. And then also not like a really repetitive style. Like, I love playing Stanford all the time. And one of my favorite things about that course is that every hole feels completely different. So that's a big one for me. I think, you know, if on the PGA Tour, I'm not a fan of rolling the ball back at all. I think that's a terrible idea because people love seeing guys hit it far. And I think there's just nothing good about limiting where it's at right now. But you know, I also think that like courses that are the idea of courses being 8,000 yards and just hard because they're long, isn't that fun either. So I love number 10 at Riviera, you know, something that like requires that much, that like super precision strategy and also rewards good ball striking. I'm not a huge fan of like when architects are just clearing out all the trees everywhere. I feel like that's kind of a trend. I've played some courses around here lately where that's maybe been a little overdone, and I'm just kind of like, oh,
don't want to name any names.
I'm not going to name any names, but yeah, I mean, I get the whole original design perspective thing, but sometimes I feel like, you know, I like having to curve it around some stuff. So, you know, I'm not, don't love ton of water everywhere. I like the tree lined. I like, you know, some variety. Those kind of things. I love, there's some great McKenzie courses around here. Pasatiempo is an underrated one that's amazing. So, you know, my home course, I play out at Cal Club. Kyle Phillips did an amazing job redesigning that back in 2009. So yeah, I think in terms of designers, those come up. George Thomas did Riviera and Stanford too. So that's another one that I like a lot.
Yeah, some really good ones in there. Patrick, thank you for taking the time. Thanks for being here today. Would love to have you back anytime. Best of luck. And thank you for listening to the Tide Podcast. We'll see you later.